We come now to our 28th presentation for the week on the Book of Revelation. We're now prepared to complete the study of the Church in Thyatira by looking together at the promise to the overcomers in this church period. It was the longest church period, lasting for at least 1260 years, and possibly longer than that, if we take the overlap periods. It certainly was the most difficult period in which to maintain a living personal experience, and many found that they had to sacrifice their lives rather than to give up their faith and belief in the living truth of God. And yet, the same message was conveyed to them as to all the others, and the promise was exclusively to the overcomer. As you read in verse 26, "And he that overcometh and keepeth my words unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father, and I will give him the morning star. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches." Now let's just list now the various things that God promised to the overcomers during the Thyatira period. The first one is that God would give power over the nations. The second, he shall rule them as a rod of iron. The third, as the vessels of a potter shall I be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father. And finally, I will give him the morning star. Let's strive now to understand what's involved in these promises and why they are so appropriate to the period under consideration. Now, first of all, it says that God will give power over the nations to the people during the Thyatira period. Let's examine now what this means. First of all, why was this a very significant promise to those people? Now, back in those days, generally speaking, I say generally speaking, not universally, in what direction did the nations of the earth devote their resources and their power? To the papacy. In fact, only because the papacy was able to enlist the power of the state was she able in turn to enforce her dogmas and to persecute the true people of God. Always, the church was able to go to the state, and the state in turn accepted the laws made by the church and enforced those laws on behalf of the church. Now, this, of course, is a picture of true Babylonian principles. Because as we have learned, of course, the Christian prayer takes only problems to God. But what does the Babylonian prayer take to God? It takes solutions. Now, as you have read in A.T. Jones' very fine little publication called Opposing Principles, when the church of the early Middle Ages found themselves destitute of the power of God, and being so destitute, were unable to attract the interest and support of the masses, when the priests found it on Sunday, first of all, the farmers and other people preferred to stay home and till their fields rather than go to church, then they knew that they had to have another power to take the place of the power which they had lost. And the only alternative power was the power of the state. And so to the state they went. And because there is some mutual advantage to be gained by the state and in supporting the power of the church, the state then was prepared to give its power to the church to carry out the church's solutions to the given problem. Now the church said to the state, "We have a problem. And the problem is that work in the fields is much more interesting and attractive and meaningful to the farmers and other people on Sunday than it is to come to church. Now, we have a solution to this problem, but that solution requires your power to effect. The solution is, of course, that we pass a law which forbids people to work in their fields on God's sacred and holy day, the first day of the week. And if the state now will come to our aid to give us the power to carry out our solution, which we don't have ourselves, then, of course, the problem shall be solved." Now, by doing this, of course, the church committed a worse sin, even if that's possible, than going to God and asking him to solve their particular problem. Let's just remind ourselves of the Jewish tragedy when the Jewish nation did this very same thing at two different levels. First of all, in both cases, in dealing with Jesus Christ. Now, before Christ came to this world, and this is just a very brief review of what we've been over before in the Sabbath rest principles, Before Jesus Christ came to this world, the Jews were locked in a fearful problem situation. They were slaves of the Roman power. Now, what had put them there? Their own works, their own problem solving, their own plan making had put them under Roman domination. And they realized inescapably that they did not have the power nor the resources themselves to extricate themselves from this problem. Now, what they should have realized, of course, that any effort upon their part to solve the problem would only compound the problem, make it worse, because as so much of human works makes a problem so severe, what will more of our own works do? Make it even worse. But they couldn't see that. You know, I'm quite impressed with the fact, impressed in a very sad way, of course, that the whole history of the seven churches, of whom we spent time studying the first four so far during this week, the entire history of the seven churches underlines the fact that man does not seem to be able to reason from cause to effect. That man seems to continually possess the idea that he can succeed by using certain procedures where others failed by using the same procedures. When the Christian church, for instance, arose and they witnessed the fall of Jerusalem and saw in that the outworking of Jewish principles, would you not think that they would say, all right, now if the procedures followed by the Jews brought those results, we must be very careful not to follow the same procedures. You'd think that, but what did they do? They followed the same procedures and they reaped the same consequences. And when you come to the period of papal supremacy, then the papists, you would think, would learn the lesson too, but they didn't. When we see the awful slaughter and tragedy of the French Revolution, you think that those who witnessed that would likewise learn the lesson, now repeated again and again, but did they learn? No. Man blindly stumbles on following the same principles and procedures right along the way. And so it was then that during the Middle Ages we find this repeating of this sad and terrible mistake, with the result that when those early church fathers went to the state and asked the state to add their power to the church's solutions, we have this serious situation upon the earth. And as I was saying, of course, that the Jews before the appearance of Christ, having failed to learn the lesson of history, in their anticipation of Messiah's arrival, and knowing, of course, the Messiah would come with tremendous power, they busily made plans, solutions, out of their own minds and selfish ambitions, expecting that when the Messiah came, he would add his power to their plans and thus make their plans effective. But what they didn't realize, of course, that Jesus Christ would come already equipped with plans and solutions. And the source of those plans and solutions with which Jesus Christ would be equipped was not the Jewish nation, not man with his human devisings, but whom? The God of heaven. And therefore, their effort to divert Jesus Christ from the Father's plans to carrying out their own plans could only result, of course, in a flat refusal on the part of Jesus Christ. Now let's just draw the picture of that situation back there in the following way. Here we have, first of all, the God of heaven, and here is Jesus Christ, and Jesus, as we know, looked to God and God alone as his plan maker, commander, director, and problem solver. And we learnt, of course, from the first chapter of the book of Revelation that Jesus Christ would not be diverted from that relationship with his heavenly Father. Now, over here we have the Jews, and sadly enough, they are even supported and abetted by Christ's disciples, and they insisted that Jesus Christ ignore the Father's plans and directives and accept their plans and directives instead, that he should take the power God had given to him, and using that power was to make their plans effective. And this, of course, Jesus Christ could not do. Now, when Christ would not do that, then what do the Jews say? All right, if you will not carry out our plans, we will have nothing more to do with you whatsoever. And that wasn't really true. What they meant, of course, they have nothing more to do with him so far as supporting him or following him was concerned, but they certainly would have much more to do with him so far as revenge was concerned. I'd like to turn back now to the statement in the book Desire of Ages, where on page 391, the words are quoted which I have just made reference to. It says, they cared not for the mysterious spiritual kingdom of which he spoke. The insincere, the selfish who had sought him no longer desired him. If he would not devote his power and influence to obtain their freedom from the Romans, they would have nothing to do with him. Now, when they learned, as they eventually had to do after the feeding of the 5,000, that Jesus Christ would not carry out their plans, then they made some more plans. And this time, the plans they made were for Jesus Christ himself. If he would not obey them, they would crucify him. Now, when they looked to Jesus Christ to carry out their plans, they looked to God's power to carry out their evil work. But when they couldn't get God's power to do it, namely, of course, they couldn't get God's power to crucify Jesus Christ, then whose power did they seek and obtain? Right, the power of the state, the power of the Romans. And so in like manner, and I'm just telling that, just reminding ourselves of that particular development in the days of the Jews and the actual lifetime of Jesus Christ, in order to notice the similarity between the procedures adopted by the apostatizing Christian church, which had become the papacy, as they moved from one area of power to another area of power. Now, just as when the Jews knew they lost the power of Jesus Christ, they turned to the Romans, so likewise the apostatizing church around about 300 AD or thereabouts, when they knew they had lost the power of God, then they turned to the power of the state too. And this, of course, is an inevitable procedure. Now, it's worthy of notice, of course, that just as there are two powers in the world available to us, the power of God or the power of man, so there are two rivers, Euphrates, on which Babylon sits. Well, she sits mainly on the second one, of course. But where do we read about the first great river, Euphrates? Pardon? No, in the Garden of Eden. The first great river, Euphrates, in the Garden of Eden. Let's turn back there a moment and notice that fact in, I think, about the first or second chapter, where it talks about the great rivers that is chapter 2. And we begin with verse 8 of the second chapter. It says, and the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight, and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first is Pison, that is it which compasses the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good, there is Delium and the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon, the same as it that compasses the whole land of Ethiopia. And the name of the third river is Hiddekel, that is it which goeth toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is Euphrates. Now, we read about the tree of life back in verse 8. What was this river? The river of life. And we're reading here, of course, of those wonderful days before sin marred God's perfect handiwork. And therefore, this was in fact a river, the supplier of which was God himself. Now, it is God's intention, of course, that men should ever depend only upon his power, upon him as the source of supply, upon him as the one who solved their problems, made their plans, protected them, and led them every inch of the way. Now, there is no mistake that the great river upon which Babylon sat centuries later is also called the great river Euphrates. And the whole symbolism is very, very powerful and very, very interesting. Now, let's take a look now at the ancient city of Babylon, which was four square. And running across that river diagonally was the great river Euphrates. It ran across like this, passed through the city, and came out the other side. And that river was literally the river of life to that great metropolis. Within the walls of Babylon, there is sufficient soil, sufficient land area, some of it, of course, in hanging gardens, but sufficient land area to maintain their flocks and herds, and to grow sufficient food to keep those people supplied forever, provided the river flowed on. If the river dried up, then what? they would perish because they had no rainfall, I don't think, in that area. And they had very little rain. They were not dependent upon the rain. They were dependent upon irrigation from the river, which was fed by snow fields in the mountains far to the northwest of where they were. Now, we recognize, of course, that Babylon back there has a modern counterpart today. And modern Babylon likewise sits upon, and she's the woman of Revelation chapter 17, and that great Babylon sits upon many waters, and those waters, we are told, are the peoples and nations and tongues of this earth. Now, God gave to mankind great powers of mind, great powers of body, and certainly great powers in the world around about us. And God intended, of course, that those powers should ever be used for His service, for the upbuilding of His kingdom, and the furtherance of His cause. But now we find that Babylon has diverted those peoples and those powers away from the service of God to her own service, and she depends upon the God-given gift, perverted, of course, to maintain her power. Now, what does Babylon depend upon? She depends upon money, power, and people power. Isn't that true? On money, power, and people power. Therefore, numbers and wealth are always a very important consideration for Babylon. But what about the true people of God? What do we depend upon? Right, we depend upon the power of God, and that's the only power that the true church of God should ever be concerned about. And any material necessity, such as money or machinery or whatever that is necessary for God's cause, we leave that to God to take care of. And if we lose those material things, it does not change our relationship to God, nor does it materially change the onward progress of God's message. God supplies again as the need may be. So then, as we enter the Dark Ages period, Babylon once again sits astride the river of human power, having forsaken the river of divine power. And the great nations of Europe devoted their powers to the execution of the papal will, but not in every case. Let me see if I can quickly find in the story of John Wycliffe, for instance, a case where this promise was specifically fulfilled, and John Wycliffe had power over the nations instead of their having power over him. I turn back now to the book Great Controversy, and we'll read now the deliverance that was brought to this mighty reformer who stood so strongly and unfailingly for the truth of God in the Middle Ages. The King of England and his princes stood ready to support this man in the hour of his desperate trial. When, I just can't see it as quickly as I thought I should. But anyway, the facts were that when the papacy demanded that Wycliffe be brought to trial and be destroyed, the king and the princes of England, who had been won to respect the gospel truths that Wycliffe was proclaiming, refused to give their support to the papacy and instead surrounded Wycliffe with personal protection, thus completely foiling the determined hatred and purposes of the Romanists. Now, likewise, as you know, Frederick of Saxony, wasn't it, was the great protector of Martin Luther, and likewise prevented his being brought to an early death. And we're quite familiar with the great protest of the princes when those princes appeared before the emperor and stood so strongly for the Reformation principles and refused to bow to the edicts of the Roman power. And so there were situations, of course, in the Reformation period when God did give those reformers power over the nations. Now, if that power had not been obtained, if every single secular ruler, king, prince, emperor, as the case may be, if every one of them had been solely and only devoted to ruling over the reformers at Rome's behest, then what would have happened to the Reformation? It would never have survived. It couldn't have survived. And therefore, this promise was a very important one to those people at that time. But now the full and complete fulfillment of this promise is still future. We must never limit these promises, of course, just to the period of the church to which they belong. The time is coming in the very near future when, as never before, there will be a universal bond of union between all the nations of this earth, and the image of the beast will be erected in every country upon the face of the globe. Now, the erection of the image of the beast is affected by that action on the part of the states when they come to the support of the churches and give their power to the churches, who in turn, of course, give their power to Rome. It will be a universal bond of union. A worldwide death decree will be passed, and in every land upon the face of the earth, the protection of human law shall be totally and completely withdrawn from God's people. Now, even a criminal, the worst murderer, robber, hijacker, kidnapper, as the case may be, has the protection of law. And that law says that that man must be given a fair trial. Not that we believe that too many trials ought to get a fair, but that's what the law says. And a person who commits murder today knows that he will not be shot on the spot, even by grief-stricken relatives. Well, that's a possibility, of course, but the law doesn't permit that. And if the grief-stricken relatives do shoot him on the spot, they become lawbreakers, and they'll go to trial as well for taking the law in their own hands. And so even the worst criminal today is blessed by the protection of laws which permit him to be given a fair trial and to have his case heard, and thus to hopefully escape from the penalty, or at least to be given a fair punishment for what he has committed. But the time is coming when on a universal scale, the nations of this earth are going to withdraw their protection from God's people entirely. And they will be rated as outlaws. And as outlaws, of course, individuals will have full permission and authority to shoot them or kill them on sight. Let's read this on page 635 of the book Great Controversy. When the protection of human law is to be withdrawn from those who honor the law of God, there will be in different lands a simultaneous movement for their destruction. As the time appointed in the decree draws near, the people will conspire to root out the hated sect. It will be determined to strike in one night a decisive blow which shall utterly silence the voice of dissent and reproof. Now at that point of time, who has power over who? Do we have power over the nations, or will the nations have power over us? Right, the nations will have power over us, so much so that it will appear as if we are about to seal our testimony with our blood. Now let's read a little further. These very familiar words, of course, to us now. Same page, Great Controversy again, 635. The people of God, some in prison cells, some hidden in solitary retreats in the forests and mountains, still plead for divine protection, while on every quarter companies of armed men, urged on by hosts of evil angels, are preparing for the work of death. It is now, in the hour of utmost extremity, that the God of Israel will interpose for deliverance of his chosen. Saith the Lord, you shall have a song as in the night when a holy solemnity is kept, and gladness of heart, and when one goeth to come into the mountain of the Lord to the mighty one of Israel. And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lighting down of his arm, with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of the devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones. Isaiah 30:29-30. With shouts of triumph, jeering and imprecation. What does imprecation mean? Pardon? Not really. Right, swearing or cursing. Thank you. Swearing or cursing. So people are howling curses upon our heads as they make this onslaught. Throngs of evil men are about to rush upon their prey, when lo, a dense blackness, deeper than the darkness of the night, falls upon the earth. Then a rainbow, shining with the glory from the throne of God, spans the heavens and seems to encircle each praying company. The angry multitudes are suddenly arrested, their mocking cries die away, the objects of their murderous rage are forgotten. With fearful forebodings, they gaze upon the symbol of God's covenant and long to be shielded from its overpowering brightness. Now, who has power over who? Do the people of God, do the nations now have power over God's people? Or do the people of God have power over them? It's reversed, isn't it? Suddenly there's a total reversal. And this is when the promise in Revelation 2 and verse 26 achieves its complete and final fulfillment. Certainly it received a partial fulfillment during the Dark Ages. And as we said, these various nations, kings, princes, emperors and so forth well, no emperors I know of, but certainly princes and some kings, gave their support not to the papacy, but to the reformers, and thus preserved the lives of some of those very, very important men. It's a sad thing, of course, that France didn't have a king, although they nearly did. The king in France wavered for quite a long time until some very ill-advised reformer nailed a rather foolish and provocative placard to his bedroom door, and that put the king on the wrong side. It was a very rash and stupid thing to do, and probably was that little feather which tipped the scales in the wrong direction so far as the history of France is concerned. Now, as we read on, of course, in Great Controversy, we find that the wicked then set to the work of destroying themselves. Now, let's turn to verse 27, because I think in this action of the wicked, we have an explanation of this rather strange verse which says, "And he shall rule them." Now, who shall rule them? That's a question. Who shall rule them with a rod of iron? Pardon? No, not God. It says he. Now, if you go back to the previous verse, you find who he is. He that? Right. He that overcometh. So he that overcometh shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to pieces or to shivers, even as I received of my Father. Now, who else then, when Christ says, "Even as I received of my Father," and that's now Christ speaking about himself, because he also rules the nations with a rod of iron. Now, let's examine this and see. When you first read that verse 27, "And the overcomer shall rule the nations with a rod of iron and will break them to shivers," then what kind of picture does this tend to build in our minds? A physical picture of the people of God being put into a position where they wield the weapons of destruction in their hands. Gives you a picture of them standing behind bazookas and atomic bombs and flying great aeroplanes and dumping deadly weapons of destruction upon the nations, doesn't it? It gives you a picture there saying, right, we've got the power now, either you obey us or we slay you. Isn't that the picture you tend to get? Right? But is that picture consistent with our understanding of the character of God's people and with the character of God himself? No, it's not. Not at all. Yet at the same time, we can't escape the point that to rule with a rod of iron means to rule with severity, to break into shivers indicates total and complete destruction, and we can't avoid those facts, of course, and there will be destruction. In fact, when we come back to Great Controversy and meditate upon the events of the fifth and sixth plagues, which we've just been reading about in the book Great Controversy, we realize that when the power over God's people is no longer in the hands of the wicked, when they're suddenly arrested, when their mocking cries die away, when they look with fearful forebodings upon the symbol of God's covenant and long to be shielded from his brightness, when that point of time comes, and that point, as I said before, is when the wicked nations lose their power over God's people, immediately after that, the wicked nations are broken to shivers. They are ruled with a rod of destructive iron. They are slaughtered by their millions at that point of time. And it is the work of the righteous to effect that. But not one of the righteous people at that time will actually wield a weapon in their hands. As the wicked drop their weapons momentarily, no doubt, the righteous do not rush in, pick up those weapons and start cutting heads off. They don't do that. That's not the character of God, and it's not the character of God's people either. It just isn't done that way. But we recognize, of course, that this great changeover, this great awakening which takes place in the minds of the wicked, is brought about by two things, or by one thing in particular, but two results are achieved. The absolute faithfulness right down to the very point of death on the part of the 144,000. The revelation given by them that they will not permit their relationship with Jesus Christ to be changed, that they will maintain their position as sons and daughters of God, that they will not in any sense of the word take over the work of problem solver or plan maker, that they will be faithful even unto death to that principle, opens the eyes of the wicked, and they see on the one hand the beauty of God's character, and on the other hand they see the evil of their own. And they also recognize at that point of time that the papal priests and prelates do not have the capacity to solve their problems, that they have put their trust in the wrong place. And having put their trust in that wrong place, then they are worse off than if they had not done anything about the whole problem whatsoever. Let me turn now to page 654 in the book Great Controversy to understand this principle still further. And what I'm trying to open up to our minds is that this fearful destruction is a direct consequence of the apostasy of the wicked being exposed to the righteousness of God and his people. It is the righteousness of God in that situation and context which changes the attitude and purposes of the wicked from being destroyers of God's people to being destroyers of each other. It is the principle of God's way of destroying, where he destroys by doing what? Trying to save. And as the saving power of God is manifest through the righteous at this time, it will result in the destruction of the wicked. Now, I'll just read briefly from these rather familiar pages in Great Controversy, page 654. When the voice of God turns the captivity of his people, there is a terrible awakening of those who have lost all in the great conflict of life. The turning of the captivity of God's people is that transfer of power that the nations have over God's people from the nations to God's people. In other words, the power that the nations had to destroy God's people is lost. They have it no more. They can't touch God's folk anymore. And instead now, God's people have power over them. But the power that God's people have is not righteous power, but the almighty power of a sacred influence, which is in them. It's the power of the revelation of God's own character, a power whereby the wicked have their eyes open, they turn then to destroy each other and not the people of God anymore. Now, of that great destruction, I now read on page 656, Great Controversy. It tells how the unfaithful pastors admit and confess their work of deception. They openly declare the true nature of their false witness. And when they do this, of course, the multitudes are filled with fury. Now, that word fury is hardly adequate to describe their true emotions, is it? This will be the fury of all furies. It'll be a madness. It'll be a rage. That they'll just be beside themselves and more with unspeakable, indescribable anger at that point of time. Nothing will restrain them. We are lost, they cry, and you are the cause of our ruin. And they turn upon the false shepherds. The very ones that once admired them most will pronounce the most dreadful curses upon them. The very hands that once crowned them with laurels will be raised for their destruction. The swords which were to slay God's people are now employed to destroy their enemies everywhere there is strife and bloodshed. Now, what a gruesome and awful thing that will be, and we'll be witnesses of it, of course, at that point of time. It'll happen all around us, right beside us, that thing is going to happen. Now, will those nations, those ministers and people at this time be being ruled with a rod of iron? Will they? Most certainly they will. Will they be broken to shivers? Absolutely. And when you break a vessel to shivers, then how much value is it? How much useful life does it now have? None whatsoever. And so likewise, through this self-destruction as they slay each other and the seven last plagues which they have brought upon their own heads by their separation from God, the awful outpouring of God's judgments, the wicked will be literally annihilated from the face of the earth. It will be a complete and total destruction of every one of those wicked. And when the nations are thus ruled by a rod of iron, which in a certain very wonderful sense will be in the hands of God's people, then will be fulfilled in its full and final sense the promise made to the Thyatiran church. In fact, I'd like to suggest that all the promises made to any of the churches, or all the churches, will only be fully and finally fulfilled in its grandest context and beauty and power to the last generation living upon the face of the earth. And of course today, we can also experience in a minor and a limited way the promises made to each of these churches individually. And we move on to verse 28, which says, "And I will give him the morning star." And what does the morning star herald? When do you see the morning star? Before daybreak, right? And as surely as you see the morning star rise, what do you know? The dawn is not far behind. Isn't that right? The dawn is not far behind. Now, Jesus Christ could not say this to the Pergamos church or even the Smyrna church, Because during their period, they would have seen the evening star set and the darkness of the night grow deeper and deeper until they reached the midnight hour. Those were the periods of descent into deepest and darkest apostasy. But when we find the Thyatiran church opening, the darkness is still there, but eventually there came the morning star of the Reformation. And who was that morning star? John Wycliffe. When did he begin his ministry, roughly speaking? In the 14th century, somewhere about 1360. In the books I've read, they indicate that no one seems to know the exact date when he began to proclaim the truth, which is understandable, because John Wycliffe himself didn't even understand or foresee where his thoughts were leading him, and so it's impossible to say, well, that's the exact moment of time when he began his protest. But around about 1360, or a little later, perhaps 1364, was the date when John Wycliffe began that protest. Now, once that morning star arose, that wonderful and glorious gift from God, and John Wycliffe was the gift of God to the Reformation Church, then, as surely as that arose, the dawn must follow. And so it has. In the subsequent work of the Bohemians in what is now called Czechoslovakia, and those Bohemians being, of course, Hus and Jerome, followed a few decades later by the mighty work of Martin Luther. And with each of these men's arising, we find that the light is spread over greater and greater areas of the earth. It becomes brighter and brighter as more and more truth is recovered from the rubbish of error. Until we move down to the work of the Wesleys, which was a very, very powerful and effective ministry, which influenced the work in England and America here, and also was accompanied by the work of the Moravians in Europe. And then the brightest light of all so far, up until this time, of course, I mean, came in 1844 with the mighty awakening of the great Second Advent movements. The sun has now risen. The light begins to stream in brighter and brighter rays. And today, of course, we're blessed with the brightest and clearest light of all. But have we yet reached the noontide of the glorious days of the gospel? Not yet. That day is still ahead. But when that time comes, as the wise says in volume 9, we have no idea, no concept of the experience of God's people when celestial glory from above shall be mingled with persecutions from beneath. And so we have the fire and the glory during that period, the fires of persecution, the glory which comes down from above to shine upon the people of God. And it's very important that we realize today the significance of the position that we individually occupy. We understand that we do have the messages by which the work alone can be finished, the message of Sabbath rest, the message of justification by faith, the message of the true medical missionary work. We think too in terms of Sabbath rest, the character of God, and the seven angels, and all these great themes which are exactly what the people need so as to be instruments in the finishing of God's work in these last days. Now, exactly as Daniel, Meshach, and Shadrach and Abednego sat at the feet of Jeremiah and learned the great truth which fitted them to resist and even to convert the king of Babylon, and as Christ's disciples sat at his feet and learned the great truths that fitted them to be the apostles to the world, so today you and I sit at the feet of Jesus again to learn exactly those truths which in the very near future will project us into world prominence as prophets. When the words of Joel 2 shall be fulfilled, your sons and your daughters shall see visions and dream dreams. This, of course, belongs to the loud cry period. And while today the work of preparation may seem a little, shall we say, tedious, although I think we're enjoying it, if we will simply rest in the knowledge that our day of power and glory is coming, and when that time comes, you're going to be an extremely busy and an extremely successful people. The important thing, of course, today is to make that work of preparation very, very thorough indeed. And so, we read in verse 29, the council, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. At this point, we'll terminate our study of the second chapter of the book of Revelation. We haven't made much progress, I'm afraid, but I felt that we needed to gain the great and important lessons that this chapter contains, and to realize that these messages are very pertinent to our own time and have great spiritual lessons for us. We move on tonight to the message to the church at Sardis, which begins in chapter 3 and verse 1, and that'll probably be as much as we'll cover during this camp period. As I said before, when I get to the Arkansas camp meeting, we'll pick up the first one we left off, and then we'll carry on from that point. Now in Germany, this is exactly the same ground that we were able to cover down to the end of the Sardis Church when we left Philadelphia and Laodicea to be covered by them next year. Let's close at this point, and we'll now take a